Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Bill Walton. Today, I will be reading from the April 2024 issue of The Atlantic. This first article is written by Roger Karma and is titled The Grumpy Economy. Why Americans Trust Feelings More Than Facts When It Comes to Prosperity. What was the worst moment for the American economy in the past half century? You might think it was the last wheezing months of the 1970s, when oil prices more than doubled, inflation reached double digits, and the U.S. sank into its second recession of the decade. Or the 2008 financial collapse and Great Recession. Or perhaps it was when COVID hit, and millions of people abruptly lost their jobs. All good guesses, and all wrong, if surveys of the American public are to be believed. According to the University of Michigan's surveys of consumers, the most widely cited measure of consumer sentiment, that moment was actually June of 2022. Inflation hit 9% that month, and no one knew if it would go higher still. A recession seemed imminent. Objectively, it's hard to claim that the economy was in worse shape that month than it had been at those other cataclysmic times. But substantial pessimism was nonetheless explicable. Over the next 18 months, however, the economy improved rapidly and in nearly every way. Inflation plummeted to near its pre-pandemic level. Unemployment reached historic lows. GDP boomed, and wages rose. The turnaround, by most standard economic measures, was unprecedented. Yet the American people continued to give the economy the kind of approval ratings traditionally reserved for used car salesmen. Last June, the White House launched a campaign to celebrate Bidenomics, the administration's strong job creation record and big investments in manufacturing and clean energy. The effort flopped so badly that, within months, Democrats were begging the president to abandon it altogether. Some kind of irreconcilable difference seemed to have opened up between public opinion and traditional markers of economic health, as many op-eds and news reports noted. The economy is great. Why are Americans in such a rotten mood? The Wall Street Journal asked in early November. What's causing bad vibes in the economy? The New York Times wondered a few weeks later. Terms like vibe session and the great disconnect were coined and spread. More recently, consumer sentiment has improved. After falling for months, it suddenly rebounded in December and January, posting its largest two-month gain in more than 30 years, even though the economy itself barely changed at all. Yet, as of this writing, sentiment remains low by historical standards, nothing like the sunny outlook that prevailed before the pandemic. What's going on? The question involves the psychology of money and of politics. Its answer will shape the outcome of the presidential election in November. The toll of inflation on the American psyche is undoubtedly part of the story. That people hate high inflation is not a novel observation. The Federal Reserve has long been obsessed with preventing another 70s-style inflationary spiral. Its patron saint is Paul Volcker, the former Fed chair who famously broke the spiral by jacking up interest rates, which plunged the economy into a recession. But although experts and political leaders know that inflation matters, the way they understand the phenomenon is very different from how ordinary people experience it. And that alone may explain why sentiment stayed low for so long and has only now begun to rise. When economists talk about inflation, they are often referring to an index of prices meant to represent the goods and services of typical household buys in a year. Each item in the index is weighted by how much is spent on it annually. So, for instance, because the average household spends about a third of its income on housing, the price of housing, an amalgam of rents and home prices, determines a third of the inflation rate. But the goods that people spend the most money on tend to be quite different from those that they pay the most attention to. Consumers are reminded of the price of food every time they visit a supermarket or restaurant, and the price of gas is plastered in giant numbers on every street corner. Also, the purchase of these items can't be postponed. Things like a new couch or flat-screen TV, in contrast, are purchased so rarely that many people don't even remember how much they paid for one, let alone how much they cost today. The irony is that consumers spend a lot more, on average, on expensive big-ticket items than they do on groceries or takeout, which means the prices we pay the most attention to don't contribute very much to overall inflation numbers. Less than a tenth of the average consumer's budget is spent at the supermarket. Some measures of inflation, core and supercore inflation among them, exclude food and energy prices altogether. That is reasonable if you're a Fed official focused on how to set interest rates, because energy and food prices are often extremely sensitive to temporary fluctuations caused by, say, a drought that hurts grain harvests or an OPEC oil supply cut. But in practice, these measures overlook the prices that matter most to consumers. This dynamic alone goes a long way toward explaining the gap between the economy and Americans' perception of it. Even as core inflation fell below 3% over the course of 2023, food prices increased by about 6%, twice as fast as they had grown over the previous 20 years. I think that explains a huge part of the disconnect. Paul Donovan, the chief economist at UBS Global Wealth Management, told me. You won't convince any consumer that inflation is under control when food prices are rising that fast. Consumers say as much when you ask them. In a recent poll commissioned by The Atlantic, respondents were asked what factors they consider when deciding how the national economy is doing. The price of groceries led the list, and 60% of respondents placed it among their top three, more even than the share that chose inflation. This isn't exactly a new development. In 2002, Donovan told me, Italian consumers were convinced that prices were soaring by nearly 20%, even though actual inflation was a stable 2%. It turned out that people were basing their estimates on the cost of a cup of espresso, which had abruptly risen as coffee makers rounded their prices up after the introduction of the euro. What's more, most people don't care about the inflation rate so much as they care about prices themselves. If inflation runs at 10% for a year and then suddenly shrinks to 2%, the damage of the past year has not been undone. Prices are still dramatically higher than they were. Overall, prices are nearly 20% higher now than they were before the pandemic. Grocery prices are 25% higher. When asked in a survey last fall what improvement in the economy they would most like to see, 64% of respondents said lower prices on goods, services, and gas. But what about wages? Even adjusted for inflation, they have been rising since June of 2022 and recently surpassed their pre-pandemic levels, meaning that the typical American's paycheck goes further than it did prior to the inflation spike. But wages haven't increased faster than food prices, and most people think about wage and price increases very differently. A raise tends to feel like something we've earned, Betsy Stevenson, an economist at the University of Michigan, told me. Then we go to the grocery store, and it feels like those just rewards are being unfairly taken away. If inflation is, in fact, the main reason the American people have been so down on the economy and its future, then the story is likely to have a happy ending, and soon. My great-grandmother loved to reminisce about the days when a can of Coke cost a nickel. She didn't, however, believe that the country was on the verge of economic calamity because she now had to spend a dollar or more for the same beverage. Just as surely as people despise price increases, we also get used to them in the end. A recent analysis by Ryan Cummings and Neil Mahoney, two Stanford economists and former policy advisors in the Biden administration, found that it takes 18 to 24 months for lower inflation to fully show up in consumer sentiment. People eventually adjust, Mahoney told me. They just don't adjust at the rate that statistical agencies produce inflation data. Mahoney and Cummings posted their study on December 4, 2023, 18 months after inflation peaked in June of 2022. As if on cue, consumer sentiment began surging that month. Perhaps helping matters, food inflation had finally fallen below 3% in November 2023. There is another story you can tell about consumer sentiment today, however, one that has less to do with what's happening in grocery stores and more to do with the peculiarities of tribal identity. It's well established that partisans on both sides become more negative about the economy when the other party controls the presidency. But this phenomenon is not symmetrical. In a November analysis, Mahoney and Cummings found that when a Democrat occupies the White House, Republicans' economic outlook declines by more than twice as much as Democrats does when the situation is reversed. Consumer sentiment data from the polling firm Civics and the Pew Research Center show that Republicans' view of the economy has barely budged since hitting an all-time low in the summer of 2022. Meanwhile, although sentiment among Democrats has recovered to nearly where it stood before inflation began to rise in 2021, it remains well below its level at the end of the Obama administration. It may never return to its previous heights. Over the past decade, the belief that the economy is rigged in favor of the rich and powerful has become central to progressive self-identity. Among Democrats ages 18 to 34, who tend to be more progressive than older Democrats, positive views of capitalism fell from 56 to 40% between 2010 and 2019, according to Gallup. Dim views of the broader economic system may be limiting how positively some Democrats feel about the economy, even when one of their own occupies the Oval Office. According to a CNN poll in late January, 63% of Democrats aged 45 and older believed that the economy was on the upswing, but only 35% of younger Democrats believed the same. To fully embrace the economy's strength would be to sacrifice part of the modern progressive's ideological sense of self. The media may be contributing to economic gloom for people of every political stripe. According to Mahoney, One possible explanation for Republicans' disproportionate economic negativity when a Democrat is in office is the fact that the news sources many Republicans consume, namely right-wing media like Fox News, tend to be more brazenly partisan than the sources Democrats consume, which tend to be a balance of mainstream and partisan media. But mainstream media have also gotten more negative about the economy in recent years, regardless of who's held the presidency. According to a new analysis by the Brookings Institution, from 1988 to 2016, the sentiment of economic news coverage in mainstream newspapers tracked closely with measures such as inflation, employment, and the stock market. Then, during Donald Trump's presidency, coverage became more negative than the economic fundamentals would have predicted. After Joe Biden took office, the gap widened. Journalists have long focused more on surfacing problems than on highlighting successes. Bringing problems to light is an essential part of the job, but the most recent shift could be explained by the same economic pessimism afflicting many young liberals. Many newspaper journalists, after all, are liberals themselves. In other words, the media's negativity could be both a reflection and a source of today's economic pessimism. What happens to consumer sentiment in the coming months will depend on how much it is still being dragged down by frustration with higher prices, which will likely dissipate, as opposed to how much it is being limited by a combination of Republican partisanship and Democratic pessimism, which are less likely to change. Will the place that it finally settles in come November matter to the election? How people say they are feeling about the economy in an election year, alongside more direct measures of economic health, such as GDP growth and disposable income, has in the past been a good predictor of whom voters choose as president. A healthy economy and good sentiment strongly favor the incumbent. Despite all the abnormalities of 2020, a pandemic, national protest, a uniquely polarizing president, economic models that factored in both economic fundamentals and sentiment predicted the result and margin of that year's presidential election quite accurately, and much more so than polling, according to an analysis by the political scientists John Sides, Chris Tosanovich, and Lynn Vavrick. It is, of course, possible that consumer sentiment is becoming a more performative metric than it used to be, a statement about who you are rather than how you really feel, and perhaps less reliable as a result. Still, the story that voters have in their heads about the economy clearly matters. If that story were influenced solely by the prices at the pump and the grocery store or the number of well-paying jobs, then, absent another crisis, we could expect the mood to be buoyant this fall, significantly helping Biden's prospects for re-election. But the stories we tell ourselves are shaped by everything from the news we read to the political messages we hear to the identities we adopt. And, for better or worse, those stories have yet to be fully written. Now, that article titled "The Grumpy Economy" was written by Roger Karma, who is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Support for this project was provided by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. This next article is written by Sarah Zhang and is titled "After the Miracle." Cystic fibrosis once guaranteed an early death, but a medical breakthrough has given many patients a chance to live decades longer than expected. What do they do now? They call it the purge. You have experienced in a modest way something like it in the waning days of a bad cold, when your lungs finally expel their accumulated gunk. The rattle in your chest quiets, your sinuses clear. You smell again, the animal sweetness of your children's hair, the metallic breeze stirring a late summer night. Your body, which oozed and groaned under the yoke of illness, is now a perfectly humming machine. Living is easy. Everything is easy. How wonderful it is to breathe, simply breathe. Imagine, though, that you had never been able to simply breathe. Imagine that mucus, thick, copious, dark, had been accumulating since the moment you were born, thwarting air and trapping microbes to fester inside your lungs. That you spent an hour each day physically pounding the mucus out of your airways, but even then your lung function would spiral only downward in what amounted to a long, slow asphyxiation. This was what it once meant to be born with, cystic fibrosis. Then in the fall of 2019, a triple combination of drugs began making its way into the hands of people with the genetic disease. Trikafta corrects the misshapen protein that causes cystic fibrosis. This molecular tweak thins mucus in the lungs so it can be coughed up easily. In a matter of hours, patients who took it began to cough, and cough, and cough, and cough, in what they later started calling the purge. They hacked up at work, at home, in their car, in bed at night. It's not that they were sick. If anything, it was the opposite. They were becoming well. In the days that followed, their lungs were cleansed of a tar-like mucus, and the small tasks of daily life that had been so difficult became unthinkingly easy. They ran up the stairs. They ran after their kids. They ran 10Ks. They ran marathons. Cystic fibrosis once all but guaranteed an early death. When the disease was first identified in the 1930s, most babies born with CF died in infancy. The next decades were a grind of incremental medical progress. A child born with CF in the 50s could expect to live until age 5. In the 70s, age 10. In the early 2000s, age 35. With Trikafta came a quantum leap. Today, those who begin taking the drug in early adolescence, a recent study projected, can expect to survive to age 82 and a half, an essentially normal lifespan. CF was one of the first diseases to be traced to a specific gene, and Trikafta is one of the first drugs designed for a specific inherited mutation. It is not a cure, and it doesn't work for all patients, but a substantial majority of the 40,000 Americans with CF have now lived through a miracle, a thrilling but disorienting miracle. Where they once prepared for death, they now have to prepare for life. It's like the opposite of a terminal diagnosis, Jenny Livingston told me. Jenny spent her 20s in and out of the hospital for CF-related lung infections. During her frequent weeks-long stays, she made some of her best friends in the CF ward, only to watch them succumb, one by one, to the disease that she knew would eventually kill her too. More than anything, she hoped to live long enough to see her daughter graduate from high school. Today, Jenny is 36. 4 years into taking Trikafta, she's the healthiest she's been in her adult life. Her daughter is 14, a lanky high school freshman. They're both obsessed with Harry Styles, and after Jenny started on Trikafta, they flew together to see him live, twice. They learned to hunt deer with Jenny's partner, Randy. They often go up into the aspen and fir-topped mountains that overlook their little town in central Utah. Jenny's last hospitalization, 4 years ago, just before she started Trikafta, is now more distant in time than her daughter's future graduation. Having lived one life defined by cystic fibrosis, Jenny wonders, what is she going to do with her second life? Jenny was born in 1987, the youngest of her parents' 5 children together, and the 3rd to have cystic fibrosis. Given the family history, the doctors knew how to test her as an infant, wrapping her forearm in plastic until a sheen of sweat appeared on their skin, the classic sweat test for cystic fibrosis. The faulty protein in CF cannot control the balance of salt and water in the body, which results in mucus that is unusually thick and sweat that is unusually salty. In medieval Europe, centuries before anyone understood why, a proverb foretold the fate of children with salt on their skin. Woe to the child who tastes salty from a kiss on the brow, for he is cursed and soon will die. The 1980s, suffice it to say, were not the Middle Ages. By the time Jenny was born, her 2 older sisters with cystic fibrosis, Shannon, age 8, and Teresa, age 7, were on a strict schedule of mucus-clearing chest therapy and medications that had kept them alive past toddlerhood. Shannon wasn't diagnosed until she was 13 months old. "I knew when she was born that there was something wrong," their mother, Lisa, told me. As a newborn, Shannon projectile vomited and blew out her diapers constantly. When she got older, she was often so insatiably hungry that she would cry when a spoon scraped the bottom of a near-empty food jar. She scarfed down 5 pancakes at a time. In the baby photos in Lisa's scrapbook, she's all skinny legs and big, swollen belly, a classic sign of malnutrition. Shannon was starving, it turned out. Food was passing through her body undigested because her pancreas had been damaged as a result of thick mucus blocking the ducts that release digestive enzymes. Cystic fibrosis was originally named, in fact, for the fibrous cyst that a 1930s pathologist saw in the pancreases of babies who had died. An early epiphany helped doctors overcome the malfunctioning pancreas, though. The missing enzymes could be replaced with pills. By the time of Shannon's diagnosis, CF was known as a disease of the lungs, in which sticky mucus made fertile ground for bacteria, and the cycle of infection and scarring would eventually cause the lungs to fail. This article, titled After the Miracle, continues, but we are out of time for today, so I will finish it in next week's program. And that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the April 2024 issue of The Atlantic. I'm Bill Walton. So long. Until next time.